Welcome back. I'm speaking today with Ambassador Christopher Hill, who served as ambassador to Iraq, Korea, Poland, and Macedonia. He was Assistant Secretary of State for East Asian and Pacific Affairs and was a special envoy to Kosovo and a member of the team that negotiated the Bosnian Peace Agreement in Dayton. He's currently the Dean of the Joseph Korbel School of International Studies at the University of Denver. Welcome to the Radio Cafe, Ambassador Hill.
Thank you very much.
So you are coming to Santa Fe to speak at a fundraiser for the Council on International Relations this Saturday, which I must add, I believe the tickets are sold out. But I understand your talk is titled Major Foreign Policy Changes Facing the U.S. Can you discuss some of those policy changes?
Well, sure. Actually, it's foreign policy challenges facing the U.S. You know, it seems that as often as the United States tries to say, you know, enough is enough, we get drawn back into things. And, you know, one of the efforts of the Obama administration was to sort of move away from things in the Middle East, the problems of the Middle East, to the possibilities and opportunities that are posed in East Asia. And like a lot of things in life, there are some unintended consequences, first of which is that I think there's been a perception that the U.S. was less interested in the Middle East than it had been. The second problem has been that the Europeans saw this pivot over to Asia as somehow weakening the transatlantic relationship. And the third, I think, unintended consequence was the notion that by focusing more on East Asia, we're focusing more on confronting China rather than embracing the opportunities that exist in that part of the world. So I thought I'd talk about all three issues and pay some attention to the continuing problems in the Middle East, not only the problems of extracting our troops in Afghanistan, but I think especially the Syrian issue, which is, I think, historically probably the most serious lasting implication of the Arab Spring of 2 years ago.
Well, we'll definitely get to Syria. I do want to ask one question because I understand in an interview in 2008 in the Seattle Times that you spoke about the United States relationship with China as the most important bilateral relationship in the world. Do you still feel that that's true?
Absolutely, I do. First of all, in the context of that, of course, was that I was the U.S. negotiator in something called the Six-Party Talks aimed at the denuclearization of North Korea. And the six-party talks, which involved China, Russia, U.S., South Korea, North Korea, and Japan, were chaired by the Chinese. And so it was my view then and is my view today that when the U.S. and China can work together, I think we can move mountains. And it is a relationship, when you look at the trade flow, the people flow, all kinds of things with China, it is a relationship that is really too big to fail.
And how is our relationship now? Do you have any inside information on that relationship?
Well, it's obviously a very troubled relationship. There are, first of all, China, like a number of countries, is going through a sort of bout with nationalism. And this has manifested itself in the Chinese having increasingly turbulent relationships in their neighborhood. They have certainly created a lot of problems for themselves in Southeast Asia by asserting their view of the their maritime rights to the South China Sea, essentially trying to claim it's a southern Chinese lake. That has caused problems with Vietnam, Indonesia, Malaysia, and the Philippines. So the Chinese have not handled that very well. Secondly, they've had island disputes with the Japanese that they've not managed very well. And by the way, the Japanese are also going through a little bout of nationalism. There seems to be something in the air. And so I think the Chinese have had to have been looking at this, and they have often kind of blamed the United States for their problems. In the meantime, I think many people in the U.S. look at China as somehow a country that's seeking to displace us as the world's premier power. I would argue that's really not the case, but in any event, there is certainly a lot of mistrust in the relationship.
And it's also, I think, we must just be intimidated because of the sheer size and the sheer power and potential that is clear in China.
Yes, I mean, it is a force to be reckoned with. We're looking at 1.3 billion people there. We're looking at an economy that is slowing down, but slowing down to about 7 or 7.5% growth, which I think most parts of the world would just grab that figure and be very happy with it. So I think it is a challenge for us, and also they frankly don't share our values on many things, especially governance and democracy.
Right. Well, speaking of not sharing our values, let's also touch on Syria, which seems to be occupying the news endlessly now. You wrote an op-ed piece in the New York Times in May called When to Talk to Monsters, about the need for diplomacy with Mr. Bashar al-Assad, Syria's president. Can you tell us about that article and about the state of Syria right now?
Yes. I mean, the concept of the article was not just talking to dictators, which I feel we have to do, and that's my legacy of working with Dick Holbrooke and dealing with Milosevic in Bosnia, and then on my own dealing with Milosevic in Kosovo. But it's also based on the idea that if you're going to be involved militarily, and there's a lot of pressure in the United States, so we should be arming the rebels. If you're going to give weapons to someone, you should also have a sort of political plan for what it is you want to accomplish. And to have a political plan, you really need to work with others, and I think we need to work with the Western Europeans who are very interested in this, but also work with the Russians and work with the parties on the ground. And if you put yourself in a position where you can only talk to some of the parties, not the other parties, you've kind of marginalized yourself. So I think the decision early on that, Bashar al-Assad must go, which is certainly justifiable on the face of it. I mean, this is not someone who, one should want to do business with. But the problem is we kind of marginalized ourselves in the process by relegating the United States to only dealing with the opposition. I think part of the problem was we looked at Syria at the time as another sort of domino in the Arab Spring and thought that Assad will be gone within weeks or months, as was Gaddafi in Libya. And, of course, the problem in Syria is far more complex than some of these other issues and just goes on and on. And today I think it's still going on. And, frankly, there's no end in sight.
And it seems that the administration, as early as this week, is finally recognizing he may still be in power for another year, if not more. Yeah. So they're embracing this.
Well, I think one of the things people have to ask themselves is, why would anyone fight for Bashar al-Assad? I mean, this is not a person that should really inspire that kind of loyalty. So why are the Druze still fighting on his side? Why are the Christians? Why are even the Kurds on his side? And the answer is they fear the future more than they fear him. And the future is that they're concerned about the opposition, which is very largely Sunni, which I think is a point not made enough in the U.S. discussion about this. We tend to look at the opposition as people who want democracy, whereas Assad wants dictatorship. And that's, to be sure, a fault line, but I think the real fault line there is sectarianism. So a lot of these minorities in Syria, including Assad's own minority of the Alawites, they don't want to live under a Syria that is run by Sunni Islamicists. So they want to see what is Syria going to look like in the future. And that gets back to my point about we need a kind of political plan, working with other countries on what sort of constitutional arrangements there will be in Syria, such that a Christian Syrian need not fear a change of government.
And you've said after them fearing the future even more than they fear him, which I thought was a very powerful statement. We didn't explain what would happen the day after he's gone. And if we're talking about this, who should be deciding what Syria will look like?
Well, in Bosnia, people often draw an analogy between contemporary Syria and Bosnia in the 1990s because of the degree to which the combatants have targeted the other person's civilians. And to be sure, that has been a real issue. I mean, Bosnia had over 100,000 civilians killed. That's also happening in Syria. But I think there's one big difference, which was in Bosnia, the United States, the Western Europeans, the Russians, were able to come together on something called the Contact Group Plan. So a lot of what happened in Bosnia after 1994 and culminating in the Dayton Peace Agreement in November 1995, was an effort to implement a political plan known as the Contact Group Plan. I think we need some effort like that in Syria. Not to say that the issue is the same or that people would embrace a kind of federalist structure for Syria. I think right now Assad wouldn't embrace any changes. But I think there needs to be a real effort by people who are interested in this problem to try to coalesce, if not around a table, then around some ideas. And so I think it's especially important in Syria because of the way the problem has metastasized. We're seeing heightened levels of violence in Iraq not seen for several years. And those levels of violence in Iraq are directly attributable to the conflict in Syria.
Now, there are some ongoing discussions about a Geneva peace conference on Syria. What is the status of that, and is there likelihood?
Doesn't seem to be moving on any fast train that I've been able to see. I think, though, the problem is that, as we discovered in Dayton, and again, I don't want to always be talking about Dayton, but I think it's a useful example.
And it was a success.
So why not talk about successes?
Right, right.
But I think the problem is that we understood in Dayton that as soon as you bring people around a table, they'll start throwing the bottled water at each other, and that therefore you should maybe try to talk to them individually to shop certain ideas. For example, does Group A agree with a Syria within its existing international borders? Probably they do. So check with Group B and Group C and see if they can all agree on that and call that point one. And then try to come up with some governance structure. Should there be a parliament that has one person, one vote in one chamber, whereas in the other votes, in another chamber, you might have a parliament sort of like our Senate in the United States, where there's representation of land, not just the numbers of people. So these kinds of questions, I think, need to be shopped around through some kind of shuttle diplomacy process, and I don't see that happening at this point. And I think that's far more important than trying to get people around a table where they're going to disagree, and then it will look like the process is further set back.
And you don't see this shuttle or these back channel negotiations happening. Why is that?
Oh, I think there's some of it going on, to be sure, but I think most people would be hard pressed to say what precisely is the U.S. position on Syria or anyone's position. It seems to be Assad must go, but there doesn't seem to be much follow-up to what that means. And the trouble with saying Assad must go is if you believe he needs to be part of the negotiation, people usually get very grouchy about participating in negotiations whose purpose is to get rid of them.
Imagine that, right?
Yes.
Well, and some of the other obstacles that are coming up have to do with the Russians and the Iranians, they would like them to be part of this process, and the U.S. is taking a stance both against Russia and against Iran. So discuss that a little bit.
It's not easy, and in fairness to the people doing it now, as opposed to what we were doing in Bosnia, is Russia under Putin is a different Russia than it was under Yeltsin. In Yeltsin's time, it wasn't easy dealing with them, but we could make progress. Today, we're dealing with someone who seems to relish disagreeing with us on everything, including the time of day. So I think it has not been an easy chore to try to deal with the Russians. And one of the very admirable things about Secretary Kerry is the way he seems to go straight to the toughest problems, whether it's Arab-Israel issues or trying to achieve some agreement with the Russians.
And what about Iran? Where's our block there?
Well, Iran has been, there's no question they are trying to develop nuclear weapons, and there's no question that this is an extremely dangerous process, because if the Iranians get away with it, it's pretty sure that the Saudis will try it and others will try it, and it will make the non-proliferation treaty a real mockery. So we have to be absolutely attentive to that issue. The problem is that the Iranians are protecting their Shia allies and partners in places like Syria, but also in southern Lebanon, hence Hezbollah. Hezbollah cannot survive a day without a friendly Syrian regime, and the concern they would have if Assad falls is that you get a Sunni centric regime, if you will, that might not be prepared to accept the aid from Iran to be passed on to Hezbollah. So Hezbollah is very concerned about this. The Iranians are very concerned about being the big losers, because in the Middle East today, this Sunni-Shia issue, which, you know, emerged in the Middle East some 1,300 years ago, I mean, this is not a new one, but it goes through periods of quiescence and then periods when it's a big problem. And right now you can see the Middle East kind of lining up in this Shia versus Sunni situation, I think a civil war in Syria. And so the Iranians, I think, are very concerned that they'll be on the losing end. That's why they've been so assiduous about backing up Assad. Somehow we need to have a dialogue with the Iranians on this while not in any way giving them a pass on the nuclear question. And that's why I think the Obama administration has been very careful on this score.
I'm speaking today with Ambassador Christopher Hill. He's former ambassador to Iraq, Korea, Poland, Macedonia. He'll be in Santa Fe this weekend. You are a diplomat here, and sometimes I fear that Americans view diplomacy as, for lack of a better word, being un-American, that somehow brute force is a much more effective tool. When did we start really losing this, and how can we reclaim it?
Well, I think to some extent Americans have come to equate our international relations with the deployment of our troops. And by the way, our troops, our army, our military is the finest in history. They have done things that no other army in the world has ever done. They have fought wars to liberate other people. So there's much to be commended about our military engagement in the world. That said, I think we need to be very careful about not sending soldiers when what we really need are diplomats. And I think there is a tendency in this country to say that diplomats talk too much and are not and don't get to the issue fast enough. But if you think about what diplomacy is intended to do, it's to try to find practical problems to things. It's to try to get people to agree on things who wouldn't otherwise agree. And I think looking for practical solutions and moving on is as American as apple pie. And I think people need to develop, I think, a stronger sense that there's nothing wrong with being out there and trying to solve problems the old-fashioned way by talking through those issues. I'm just writing a book on this whole subject, which will be out in Simon & Schuster next spring, but I think it's very important that people come to understand that diplomacy is not forced by other means. It's a means to, I think, have American influence in the world, to make friends, to influence people, to do things that Americans, I think, know very well how to do.
And particularly in this economy, it is a much more it is a less costly option. I mean, the Pentagon just outlined for Congress some of the military options available for intervention in Syria. General Dempsey noted some of the options going in, like airstrikes, imposing no-fly zones, could run $1 billion a month.
Well, I think General Dempsey was pointing out a fact known to many people who know the details, that there are no good options militarily, and that people need to understand that you cannot solve every problem through military means. So I think it was very important that he pointed that out. I mean, often when countries go to war, there's a certain amount of adrenaline that goes into that process. And so to say that we should be in country X for 30 years, it's a nice thing to say, but it's not going to happen, because I think Americans really want to see our forces used decisively and not to be deployed somewhere forever. And, you know, for me, living in a place like Colorado and seeing all the problems we have and, the school systems and things like that, it's hard to make the case that we should not have more schools for, Pueblo County while we build schools in Afghanistan. So I think we need to be respectful of the fact that American people have their own issues, and the issue is to try to balance what we do here with our efforts overseas and not allow our efforts overseas to be unending and essentially undermining any interest of Americans in being overseas.
Thank you, Ambassador Christopher Hill, for being with us on the Radio Cafe. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Zaylee, sitting in for Mary Charlotte.